Session number 30423, Reel 1.
If we could start with when and where you were born.
Well, my name, Edmund James Everly Stowers. I was born on the 8th of January, 1924, in the parish of Pitminster in Somerset. My parents lived in the little village of Trull, where my father was employed by his ex-colonel in the Royal Horse Artillery, as he'd been an old contemptible, having joined before the Great War, and had married my mother, who he met whilst they were on exercises at Okehampton, gun exercises, and my mother had been a nurse with, I think, Lady Astor's nursing service in Plymouth during the First World War. They came to Teignmouth when I was about the age of two, and we lived in a 18th century house with very thick cobble walls, a very happy family, an elder brother and sister, a younger sister, Edwin, Evelyn and Dorcas. My elder sister became a state registered nurse, and actually was in the Royal Devon and Exeter Hospital during a war, and at the time when people came back from Dunkirk, the soldiers, and I remember telling me they came back filthy, sand, torn clothing. My elder brother worked in a solicitor's office, but joined the Royal Navy before the war as a writer, but was invalided out and became an Admiralty officer eventually in Mauritius, Mombasa and New Delhi. Coming back to England in Bath, but left, it went to a completely different career and became in charge of homes, remand homes. My younger sister was the only one who went to grammar school. I think our family were very poor, and I know they could not afford to further education for any of us except the younger daughter, and she became a school teacher. When I mentioned being poor, yes, but we lacked for nothing. My father had an allotment to grow on vegetables. He was employed, but smashed his arm up on an old T-Ford. We used to crank them up, and it backfired, came back and smashed his wrist. No such thing in those days as conversation. I left at the age of 14 and became a telegram boy in the post office.
Had you enjoyed school?
Sorry?
Had you enjoyed school? Had you enjoyed school?
School? Yes. Very, very much. And I think there's a reason. Our school teachers, I would say 75% of them, had served in the Great World War. And so they were that way inclined with discipline. It's a very disciplined environment, but also very traditional. We celebrated Empire Day, Armistice Day, and I had the honour of being the boy who, on one year, read the, when you go, which is now the British Legion epitaph. Yes, it was a strict schooling. When I left school at the age of 14, which I had enjoyed, I'm not particularly athletic, but I did enjoy schooling. And my last master, Mr. Smith, said to me one day, if you would like to continue education, come to my house evenings and I'll help you. You won't go very far in life without it. And I owe a lot to that man, because the next 2 or 3 years I would go to his home and I would have private lessons free of charge. I have no certificates to prove anything, but at least I had an unusual education.
Private lessons in what subjects? In what subjects did he?
We did English, writing, letter writing, the correct way to do English, literature, reading, mathematics, or we would call them sums in those days. Those are the main subjects, reading, writing and arithmetic, the 3 R's, 4 R's. A little geography, but basically the elementary education. But it was far more advanced than I had at the age of 14.
What do you remember of Teignmouth itself at the time?
Well, Teignmouth, in the 30s, it had suffered a recession somewhat in employment, that my wife's father was a shipwright. He had left Teignmouth, where he worked for a firm called Morgan Giles, to go to America, where they needed carpenters. And he went to Detroit, Maryland, building houses, but raising a good sum of money, so when he came back to Teignmouth, he could buy a house in Ivy Lane by the river beach. The hotels along the seafront were very popular with families who would come year after year. Some would come with their own servants, their own nannies. It was that type of holiday resort, basically for the middle and upper class holiday makers. It had a pier, it had a den, a bowling green, but above all it had a very peaceful coastal environment with Dartmoor in the background for people who could travel. It was a simple life. I think the majority of Teignmouthians were divided into those who worked in domestic or in shops, or those who were in the middle or upper class. You start with the solicitors and bankers and the wealthy people. There were quite a substantial amount of families here with money. Hence some of the very nice houses around the outskirts of Teignmouth. It's dramatically changed. That environment is completely gone. As children, what would we do? We roller skated. We had a box cart. I had a very, very good box cart. In fact, not long ago, I met a friend of mine who's also in his 80s. He said, hello, Jimmy. Do you remember our box cart? I thought, after all these years. So it shows how important that type of playground would have been. Going on the beach with the fishermen, putting their nets in, bringing the mackerel in, and you'd help pull the nets in. We did not do much good, but we were there because at the end we would get some fish to take home. Very simple enjoyments. Again, oh yes, Sir Alan Cobham in the 30s with his flying circus paid a visit to Teignmouth. Holden had an aerodrome, and Sir Alan Cobham came with his biplanes and his small, I can't call them airliners, but passenger planes, And my mother won a competition for one person to take a flight. Of course, that fell to me because I was about the only one who would want to go up in an aeroplane in the early 30s. And that was my first flight over Teignmouth. I still have the ticket and the photograph of the plane.
Did you have any interest in boats at that time? Did you have any interest in boating and
boating?
The sea at that time?
Yes, I had an interest in boating because I used to borrow a small skiff and try to sail it, not very successfully. Quite the opposite, my wife was a very good rower and boat person, having received education from one of the coast guards who lived nearby her. But again, yes, boating in Teignmouth was another employment. Trips in the harbour, fishing trips, trips up the river, and the regular families always took them, would take a landing trolley to the beach on big wheels. The boats would come in and you'd board their boats. Now, I remember going out in the 30s to see the Navy, HMS Furious, all the old battleships, cruisers, would come into Torbay and Teignmouth and would be open to the public. And that was one of the main events for the year. It would last about a week to 10 days. Again, a fairground would come and set up on the den, a helter-skelter roundabouts, and that was run by a family from the Channel Islands, actually. And when war broke out, they were here in September, and they packed up overnight and left Teignmouth. I was rather disappointed. I had intended to go on the helter-skelter. That's a rather silly thing to remember. I remember the day war broke out because I had been in the post office that day. We'd been busy delivering telegrams, recalling people to their units, to their ships. And I was in the telephone exchange, listening to the wireless, and the war was declared by Chamberlain, that having not received news from the German ambassador, we are now at war. It was my mother's birthday the same day. I'd taken home a small box of black magic chocolates, a great expense to me, and I gave them to my mother, who was bursting into tears, which puzzled me. Of course, I failed to realise that she and my father had lived through the Great War, and realised what would this mean to her children. In fact, I remember when I left home, when I joined up, she took me to the railway station. I was very delighted, but still could not really understand why my mother was so upset. I know better now.
Had you been much aware of what was happening in Germany and Europe during the 1930s?
Yes, in 1938, I had gone to Taunton for a holiday with my aunt, and she explained to me quite a lot about Chamberlain going to see Hitler and the agreement, and I was kept up to date by my own family, who were very interested in world affairs at that time. Although I think the majority of the people were not particularly interested or influenced But my family did follow it. And I think it is because of my father's background. When war did break out, Teignmouth was bombed very early in either the end of 39 or early 40 by a plane which had been flying up and down the seafront during the afternoon. I was on the seafront near the pier, and no one took a lot of notice. And on this last trip, dropped two bombs, which landed each side of the pier, killing a young girl called Medlin. I was probably about 100 yards from the pier itself, and I dived under a stack of deck chairs, which wouldn't have done much good anyway. But that was our first taste of what the war could really be. Then the Indian regiment with the mules came and stayed at Sheldon across the river. The Black Watch set up their headquarters at Galway in Teignmouth. The Fleet Air Arm took over Haldon Aerodrome and would fly regularly over the sea, training. Their headquarters was at the end of the Den. The Navy came and motor torpedo boats were being built at the Morgan Joe shipyard. The Den beach had scaffolding put up, anti-invasion. An interesting thing was set up at the entrance to Sheldon Bridge, a large pipe arrangement with holes all the way, and apparently fuel would have been pumped through it and squirted it instead of light, which was a very crude anti-invasion device. And I've often wondered whether my memory played me false, but I've checked since and found that was exactly true. Again, as I said, Teignmouth was very severely bombed and a lot of casualties.
How did the start of, or the outbreak of war affect the more domestic side of life in Teignmouth, and the food supplies and so on?
I think domestically, shortages began to creep in. You would queue for whatever was available. In fact, I rather laughed one day because an aunt of my wife's queued for no reason except there was a queue, and found it was for cat food, but she had no cat. Rationing, yes. There was always under-the-counter food available. My father had an allotment on the cliffs where we grew all our vegetables. We were self-sufficient with vegetables. We would also go out into the countryside. Rabbits in those days were very easily obtained, so we could get a rabbit. Or you would know someone who had something which you could barter for. So domestically, life went on. And what it surprised me, looking back, there was never a fear. People were not afraid. Bombing was accepted. Bombs dropped at a place called Second Avenue. A sailor on one leave was killed. His daughter was found in a tree. A tragedy, but it was sympathised with, but life had to go on. So there wasn't any question of morale being destroyed. Morale was very high. particularly during the Battle of Britain, I know the announcements of the planes being shot down were greatly exaggerated. But in those days, if we were told 100 were shot down, people believed it. We know now we'd be lucky if 20 were shot down. But morale was high. I also had the unpleasant job at the beginning of the war, being a telegram boy, delivering telegrams to families to say someone was missing, killed in action. I also delivered a telegram to say the Royal Pindy had been sunk, but the chief engineer who lived in Teignmouth was saved. I delivered a telegram to someone at Coombe Road to say their son, a pilot, had been shot down, but was a prisoner of war. My wife, Irene, had a telegram, which I did not deliver, saying that her brother had been killed at Narvik on the 10th of April, 1940. So we became involved in tragedies, but again, it was never a disaster to affect morale. We always believed that Britain would win. Even when we were losing severely Norway after Dunkirk. Dunkirk was interesting. They asked for a lot of boats to leave Teignmouth to go to Dunkirk. They left, but I do not believe they were used, but a number went and came back a couple of weeks later, but they were ready to go. There's no hesitation. The fishermen, the pleasure boats, all went to offer their services. So even with Dunkirk, that was never looked upon as a disaster, which it was a terrible disaster, but not at that time.
What about the threat of a German invasion?
Invasion?
Was there much concern about the threat of a German invasion in the air?
No. With years gone by, we know how near we were to being invaded. If the Battle of Britain had not been successful, if Sea Lion had gone ahead. But at that time, there wasn't a great fear of the invasion. If it came, it came. We had the LDV, which came in the Home Guard. Oh yes, I was a member of the Home Guard under the Devon Regiment, the GPO detachment. I was given a Ross rifle, which is a very old Canadian rifle. We put the bayonet on the end, it was taller than I was. We went to Cornwall to be trained with the use of firearms. We did exercises in the belief that we could repel an invasion. I know now that was a ridiculous idea. I had a Bren gun at one time. I had not the slightest idea how to dismantle it or how it would be used. But here we had a gun and we would fight. We would not have won that. Again, at the time, we wore the uniform, we believed we would fight. We practiced with sticky bombs. That is a glass cylinder on a handle with a sticky fabric on the outside, which you should rush up to the tank, smack it on, run away, and it would blow up. We practiced with that. We threw hand grenades. I've even seen some people drop them, which is fortunately were dummies. Again, I'm not being facetious, I'm being realistic. We did all these things believing we would be successful. No. That sounds a bit dismal, doesn't it?
How then did you come to join the Navy?
I waited anxiously to join the forces. Were in case the war was over where I went. It was that type of attitude. On my 18th birthday, I volunteered to join the Royal Navy. I had to go to the castle at Exeter to be medically examined and accepted. Returned home and received my papers to report to HMS Impregnable, a shore base at St. Budel, Plymouth. I was given the rank of Ordinary Telegraphist, number TJX340488. We were trained in drill, firearms. Now, I was very good at firearms in those days. I've been brought up with firearms all my life. As a young child, I had a gun. Rowing on the Tamar, all the things one should do as a sailor, but at the same time, studying Morse, wireless, until I became a qualified telegraphist. Towards the end of the course, we were given an IQ test with no explanation. I have since learned that they were looking for certain attributes to able to analyze, to be independent, not to rely on a complete team, and also that you would be secure, in plain terms, keep your mouth shut. And so at the end of the course, all my fellow seamen went to ships or store stations. I was told to go to Eastbourne, and on arrival was placed in a boarding house. Very pleasant. A landlady, nice room, good food. And by day, I went to St. Bede's College on the cliffs at Eastbourne, which had been commandeered as a girls' school, girls' college. The staff were from Bletchley Park and various military establishments, even Americans. I was taught German and Italian wireless transmissions, the type of coding, the type of work, the stations they originated from, Brest, San Jose, mainly for submarines. And at the end of the course, I qualified to be a TEL-S in brackets, S being special. My work was to be on HF, high frequency direction finding, HFDF. I returned to Plymouth, to Glen Holt, to wait a posting. Glen Holt was in the woods on the outskirts of Plymouth, Nissen huts, bitterly cold winter, fuel burning stove in the middle of it, and we raided the woods to get more wood. I was fed up being there, and when a posting came to a colleague of mine for submarines, he did not want to go. So I went up to the drafting office and said, I would like to change with him, feigning to think, what good HFDF being a submarine, which turned down promptly. Eventually, my draft came through, report to Greenock, Scotland, on the Clyde, to join HMS Anne, K-256, river-class frigate, 2 4-inch guns, 1 4.5, a new weapon on the forecastle called a hedgehog, with 24 spigots. On the end of the spigots would be placed a tube with a bomb on the end.